is the Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 53rd in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I am pleased to have with me Richard Balick. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Gary.
So Richard Balick, whose name is in fact pronounceable, is Director of Incident Response for General Electric and serves as Principal Technologist for GE's Global Infrastructure Services Division. Prior to GE, Richard ran Dow Security as an independent consultant. He also held positions at ManTech, Foundstone, and Ball Corporation. Richard was introduced to computer security as a military intelligence officer at AFCERT, the Air Force Information Warfare Center, and the Air Intelligence Agency. Richard has degrees from Harvard and the Air Force Academy, and he's written three books, including The Dow of Network Security Monitoring, and blogs at dowsecurity.blogspot.com. Dow is spelled T-A-O, by the way. His dog Scout weighs 75 pounds. I got good people.
You do. That is excellent research on parts of my website that I don't know if we're still accessible, but that's good.
So you're well known for your work in network security monitoring, something that you write and speak about regularly. In your experience, is it best to watch for known bad things or anomalies in traffic?
Great question. I like to say you should watch for everything, because at the time when you're watching, you generally don't know what is useful, especially dealing with the most interesting threats. So the approach that I like to take is to collect as much as you can, given your legal, technical, political restrictions, and then apply some level of what I call retrospective security analysis to that data once you know what to look for. Now, clearly, we have sort of a hierarchy of preferences. The first preference you would have is not to have an intrusion at all. The second preference would be to, and that would be because you don't have any vulnerabilities or there aren't any threats and so forth. Mm-hmm. The second one would be to say, well, we expect that there are some intrusions, but we're going to know what to look for. And when we see them, we'll try to react as quickly as possible. And then there's sort of a third category, which is we can expect we're going to have a problem, but we don't even know what it looks like at this point. And that's where that third level of collection and analysis comes in. Mm-hmm. So across the spectrum, you try to stop everything you know is going to be a problem. You try to look for those things that you know are a problem but you can't deal with, and then you try to have a safety net for everything else.
Sure, that makes sense. I guess part of the reason that I asked that question is when you have a really complicated system, like say a piece of software that does lots and lots of crazily different things, it's hard to know what a known bad behavior might be.
Yeah.
So you're sort of stuck with anomalies. And it seems like when it comes to software security, the mix may change as contrasted with network security monitoring. And, you know, do you believe that that's the case?
Yeah, I feel like if you are sufficiently equipped to know that something is bad, you should probably be throwing all your effort into fixing it mm-hmm. or preventing it at some degree, and not just watching for it and reacting to it.
Gotcha.
So
that makes sense. Duh.
Right. I mean, these sorts of things are intuitively obvious, but when you sort of look at the landscape of what's offered for security, generally that's not implemented. Mm-hmm. So we tend to drive, or at least we should be driving, to a situation where nothing but the most difficult problems are left over, and they're ones that we don't yet recognize.
Right.
But I think we would agree that there's so many problems that are still out there. And I think that a lot of it just comes down to, in the end, real operational problems. You know, there's a big disconnect between where effort is applied in terms of new thinking and academic research and new products, and when you end up with somebody's network that you can penetrate using a 10-year-old attack.
Right.
Because the system is running on a 12-year-old operating system. That's when it can be fairly discouraging.
So how does the knowledge of software security, which you have a lot of, by the way, you know, we sort of think of you as a software security guy, even though you're not. how does that influence network monitoring?
Well, in some ways, to me, it demonstrates that network monitoring is not sufficient for that. In fact, I've been talking to a few people about what needs to be done in terms of instrumentation so that we have the data that that is necessary to identify a problem and deal with it. I frequently encounter people who they might like the approach that we use. By the way, you know, I appreciate the reference to network, but I rely very heavily on logs, rather than very heavily on host-based evidence, memory, those sorts of things to sort of have a complete picture. But there are many people who will look and say, well, I like what you've done on the network. I'm going to apply that approach now to my web server that is only offering encrypted sessions, and I expect you to find intrusions in that scenario. And I look and I say, what is the problem you're trying to solve? Applying someone else's solution to your specific problem might not work.
Right.
And so I find that in many cases, we need to first define what the problem is. And we may find that you have, and you know, I've sort of riffed off of what you've talked about with building security in, the idea of building visibility in.
I was going to get to that. Okay. That's good. I really like that phrase.
Okay.
So we'll definitely come back around to that. In terms of incidents and forensics, what's the most interesting story you can share with us from your career? There got to be some good ones.
Boy. So that's sort of a loaded question, right? The most interesting ones. I try not to. Sometimes I'm. This issue comes up in my blog when I talk about advanced persistent threat. Like, oh well, you can't. I get put in these situations where if you tell these things, you must be violating your security clearance, and if you don't tell them, you're just making it up. I like to. One of the stories I like to remember was when I worked in the Air Force Computer Emergency Response Team in San Antonio, Texas, we were having a problem with a French aerospace company that was repeatedly trying to break into Air Force systems. And they tried the full spectrum of techniques. I don't know if they had any malicious insiders, but they certainly were going beyond just the digital. And what they tried in the regular world was they tried calling us to say, what is happening here? Could you remove some of these blocks?
Hello, could you remove the block?
Well, it was a remarkable situation because they didn't know that I spoke French. So they had a sort of a handler who was guiding the person on the phone. Uh-huh. And the two of them would sort of, you know, excuse me for a minute, they would step away, talk in French, and they didn't know that I could
you
understand what they were saying. So that, I always, you know, that's just sort of a nice reminder that sometimes these skills we have outside can help with the security problems we
face.
That's
funny. I had the same sort of thing happen at a technical advisory board meeting for FinJan when they were speaking Hebrew, but I was sitting next to Avi Rubin.
Ah, nice.
And we went for a break, and Avi said, hey, did you know what they were saying?
Right.
That was an interesting thing. How does incident response interface with the business people at GE? Like, how do you get them to understand, we had an incident, this is what happened, here's how we fixed it, here was the business implications, and
sure.
So on.
Sure, that's a great question. The way I like to think of our incident response program is we are the ultimate check on the success of our security program.
Mm-hmm.
Our team, in an ideal world, would have almost no work to do, and I would have a much smaller team. But in the real world, we have, as any large company with offices in every country in the world and 300,000 employees, you can imagine we have to spend a lot of time identifying problems where the assumptions that people make do not match the reality,
right.
Whether it's the way you implemented software or the way you set up a defense or the way you think a threat would work. So we are the ultimate check. We are the ultimate reality check. And what we try to do is take the lessons that we learn from our incident response effort and try to turn that into something that will guide better security, better configuration, better IT in general. We like to say we try to transition from being firefighters to fire marshals.
That sort of makes sense from a technical perspective, I guess. I'm thinking more of, say, a business unit guy who might not even know what the network does for his business.
So the way I deal with the business people is I try to frame everything in terms of competitiveness.
Uh-huh.
As you might imagine, we have very competitive managers, very much A-type managers who want to win.
Mm-hmm.
And when I can express to them, for example, that you remember when you were playing high school or college football, how would you have felt if someone had your playbook and knew what you were going to be calling, and they could read your signals and the whole deal? When you start framing it in that perspective,
mm-hmm.
then they start to understand why it would be important for someone to protect the information that they have from getting into any type of adversary's hands.
Gotcha. And you, do you feel by and large that, that they don't just think that you're some sort of a high wizard doing mysterious things that doesn't really matter, that they have to placate by nodding their head?
No,
or
no,
do you
not
think
all.
They really do get it?
When I talk in terms of competitiveness, the business people care about that. They don't necessarily care how I get it done.
Right.
As long as I'm being legal, I'm following the privacy concerns, I'm supporting the right type of workplace. I don't really spend time instructing them on the specifics of vulnerabilities or attacks.
Right.
I talk, when I have to talk about sort of specifics, I try to talk in terms of threats, mm-hmm. who the bad guys are. It's difficult to do this, but if you can ever get a picture of a bad guy or a group or whatever it is, and you put that on the board, that will speak much greater to a business person than there's this technique called SQL injection that you're using. They couldn't care less about that.
But actually, do you know Mikko Hipponen?
Just by reputation. Yep.
Mikko has this great set of slides that is like pictures of guys who wrote viruses in the 80s, and they look like pimply-faced teenagers.
Yeah.
And, you know, in New Jersey. And then pictures of people who write malware today, and it's like this Russian mafia guys that look dangerous. And yeah, you just go, wow. And they're real pictures.
Sure.
So I'm with you on the threat thing.
Yeah.
By the way, I appreciate the fact that you like the my definition of threat versus the way wider one. I'd forgotten about that until you just said threat.
That's true. I've always thought you've been spot on in terms of thinking about this, which, there's differing opinions, but I like the way you look at it.
So often people in software security will say, you know, there's this gigantic disconnect between security operations people and developers, and everybody's pointing the finger at everybody else. As an operations guy, what do you think of the developers? I mean, you're an enlightened operations guy, so maybe you can tell us what you think and then tell us the caricature.
Wow, I appreciate the enlightened part, but I think we still have the disconnect, I would say, is mainly one in terms of what is happening now. Mm-hmm. To me, the people who are closest to the problem who are not actually infiltrating adversary groups is the incident response team, because we see failure every day. You know, it's like, what's that movie with Bruce Willis? I don't see dead people. I see dead boxes everywhere.
Right.
So our goal is to figure out how that happened and try to come up with a fix for the future. I think the knowledge that we have, we try to bring that into IT, but then maybe it doesn't go the next step. The next step needs to be taking that to the developers so that they get educated on what's common. There's a lot of education about maybe what's been happening within the last 5 years, but what's happening within the last 6 months, what's happening now. Mm-hmm. They need that so they can apply that to future development.
Well, it probably brings the story home if incident response can go and say, hey, you know, this isn't theory. This isn't some OWASP top 10.
Right.
This is your application right here.
And the benefit we get from doing that is we tend not to know how an application works.
Right.
I mean, we need that development expertise to understand what is bad, what is good. Because I feel like the same way with software, if you knew it was bad, you probably would have figured out a way to stop it, mm-hmm. at least at a certain level of maturity.
I've certainly found that's true. I mean, the developers, by and large, actually want to make stuff that works, mm-hmm. that people use.
Sure.
So if instead of saying, you suck and your code is bad, you say to them, hey, did you know if you did it this way, it would be more secure? All of a sudden, they want to do the right thing and all is well. I think that was one of the biggest surprises that I've had over the last, I don't know, decade or so.
Yeah. I don't think anybody has sort of like a perfect shop. I've never seen a shop that is so good at IT that they can turn to the development community and say, well, if only you guys were better software, we would have no problems because my IT environment is pristine.
So that's just a caricature.
Oh, absolutely.
But entertaining one.
You could have perfectly developed software and the IT side could still be a problem. Or your hiring could be terrible. You could be hiring spies all the time, mm-hmm. and not performing the appropriate background checks or hiring competitors. And so that's what makes our jobs very difficult, is that it takes not perfection, hopefully, but really high level of maturity across all of the areas of the organization to have a significant effect.
We'll be right back after this message. The landmark 50th episode of the Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw is an interview with cybersecurity luminary Richard A. Clark. The episode was recorded in high-definition video and is available on the Silver Bullet website, www.sigital.com/silverbullet, as well as on YouTube. Make sure to check out the video. So I wanted to get into a little bit of the interaction between incident response and the guys in dev. One of the things that we uncovered in the BSIM was that some organizations have a way of closing the loop. When the incident response team finds a problem, sometimes they even have like a direct hotline to the development groups.
Right.
But some organizations actually go so far as to make sure that the loop is closed and
right.
the fixes are getting done. What, you know, in your experience, how common is that? And is that something that you've seen?
I think it depends on the frequency of the incidents you deal with and the nature of the incident. I would say you are more likely. So if you have sort of a formal software testing program, that the purpose of that is to get results back to the devs. So that happens all the time. I know it happens at our company. We have a formal process. We rely on that quite heavily. The next level we have, and this, so that group is not part of my team, but we also have a blue team, which is sort of a generic, what does the state of the infrastructure look like? If they find problems, they're going to take it to the developers as well. Mm-hmm. The next level, and this group is part of my team, is the red team, and they do adversary simulation. If we find something that's of high level, we will take that to the developers. On the incident response side, I feel like, at least in my shop, we spend so much time on, I would say, problems that don't necessarily need developer attention, that is mostly the result of an IT issue, that very rarely do we need to involve developers. It would have to be probably some sort of, and this would actually be of interest to us, you know, after dealing with the very vanilla type intrusions that we have, to find something that was, wow, we have this web-facing app and it has a problem, we would definitely take that to them, but it doesn't happen quite so much because of the other three levels that I expressed.
Sure. Yeah, well, that makes sense. I guess I was going to ask, I don't know if this makes any sense, but I'll give it a shot anyway. You know, there are problems in software, but there are also much more common configuration errors. People
yeah.
set up a server wrong, firewall is configured incorrectly. And it seems like, you know, over the history of computer security, the first big set of problems was those configuration errors. And then came software problems, and then comes design problems, and then come enclave and trust problems. That's going to be something for a decade from now. But are you in the field still seeing that mostly configuration errors are the biggest issue? Or has it moved on to bugs? And
Boy, it's a great question. You know, I don't know if I would definitely agree with what you said. I feel like all of those things have always been there.
Uh-huh.
And you probably agree with this as well. It's just a question of what you were paying attention to first.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't trying to imply that the other problems didn't exist, but I was sort of, it's wishful thinking.
Yeah.
Hoping that since we're so well aware of configuration
right.
problems, maybe we'll eradicate them and then we'll have to focus some attention on bugs.
Yeah.
And it seems like it's the time of bugs now. And so we'll begin to eradicate them.
Eventually,
and then it'll
yeah.
be the time of flaws. In terms of just, you know, sheer percentages of what's causing problems.
I feel like the issue that I see, and I wish I had numbers to back this up or whatever, is that as new technologies emerge, we're introducing the same old problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like it probably is due to the developers who worked on the original software. It's difficult to transition those lessons. So you'll see attacks that were developed in the 90s that worked against the, you know, the NT4 IPv4 stack, they get reintroduced in a new piece of software.
Because nobody knows.
Because it was sort of, well, we took care of that, didn't we? And it's a new generation of developers, and there's not really a good way to sort of bring that information forward. I know there's a lot of work around that, but that's what I tend to see.
Uh-huh.
As far as the stuff that we end up dealing with, we deal with almost, I won't say almost exclusively, but it's a lot of client-side problems.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you have a general purpose computing platform whose purpose is to execute arbitrary code, and you have a way for an intruder to introduce that arbitrary code, we continue to have issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess back in a previous Silver Bullet, we chatted about that, the risks and how they change over time with Fred Schneider. long ago if people are interested in that. You're giving a keynote at VizSec next month, which is September in Ottawa. What kinds of visualization capability does a CSO need? And how does this differ from what guys in ops need?
Yeah, so I guess it's the goal that you're trying to achieve. When you're in ops, you tend to want to see something that will either tell you there's a problem or tell you something you didn't know before so that you can investigate and maybe discover an issue. Mm-hmm. At the CSO level, you sort of want more of a feeling of how are things going today and are there problems that I can introduce a new program around. And I don't know if I've ever seen what I would consider a worthy CSO level visualization. You tend to see a lot of...
So for all the Archers of the world, we have a ways to go.
Well, you know, I think something like Archer is valuable in the ability to say, especially in the compliance piece, you can say, here are all of the compliance issues you have, and here's sort of maybe a progression as you're improving your compliance. Mm-hmm. But I think it's very difficult to render something like security, doing air quotes here, in a dashboard. It's almost like maybe we should think about how would you display the economy?
Mm-hmm.
What could you track? And then, you know, there's a few things that would come to mind, but that's probably the approach we need to take.
Yeah, so just a higher level view above the noise.
Yeah.
Talk about what the most useful thing visualizing wise, let's use English, shall we? You know, when you're doing visualization in ops, what's the most interesting?
So this is going to sound silly, but what I've found is displaying technical data in a way that makes a business person or someone who should know the business a little bit better than you do, which is almost always the case because that's their business, they look at something and say, why is that happening? In other words, if you were to sort of go to any business person and say, describe how your operation works, mm-hmm. they're going to give you some numbers and such, but they're not going to really probably give you the information that you need to sort of help them find security issues. But I found something as simple as showing them connections, like we've done the spinning globe of doom and all that.
Right.
And they look at that and they say, I didn't know that. I mean, they start wondering to themselves, do I have a business operation in Zimbabwe?
Really?
And they look at that and they say, you're meaning to show me that this much activity is happening in that country? I don't feel like we have a business operation there. And it's not anything they really thought about previously. So that's something that's very simple and very silly, I would say. But if it's a way to start a conversation about what's normal and what's not normal, mm-hmm. then it can be kind of useful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess, you know, visualizing what's normal in a dynamic system is fairly new. And it's something that, you know, like Ben Schneiderman has done at Maryland and others are quite good at some of these dynamic systems. But boy, do we suck at it in security.
Yeah, I don't even know. People talk about normal and baselining. I think really you just have to sort of show what is. Mm-hmm. Because no one really can come up with a good baseline, I think. When would you do it? I mean, there's been some examples I've heard of some new financial institutions that have started in the last year or so. They've come out of the ashes, mm-hmm. and they're starting from scratch. So they know what is new. They have a baseline. Mm-hmm. Of course, they're probably going to grow so fast that all that stuff will go out the window.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of so there's, at least with our job with detection, there's the idea of you baseline, then you look for anomalies. I find that is just very, very difficult because you can't find anyone who has the knowledge to say what is normal necessarily. And I feel it's one of the reasons why SIMs have failed is because to string those problem statements together is just too difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So the other approach you can take is to sort of collect, and then once you know what to look for, you find it. Or you use an indicator-based approach, which says, if you see this, and hopefully it's built on something you developed in your environment. If you see this could be a problem, and then you need to investigate.
Mm-hmm. So back to the building visibility and things.
Yeah.
Sounds like a great idea. So what does it mean in practice?
Yeah, so it's partially based I mentioned building security in.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that idea. The building visibility in idea is for everything that you don't know is going to be bad, at least have a way to describe the state of the computing device or software or whatever. Because when a product, you know, I've got my BlackBerry here or whatever, when it's opaque, when you can't see what it's doing, that just scares the dickens out of me. Mm-hmm. I'd much rather say, well, I do want you to make it as secure as possible, but give me a way to tell me what is the state of that device.
So do you think consumers need that too?
Consumers probably don't, because they're not equipped to deal with the output.
Right.
But it would be good to have a way to get access to it on a troubleshooting basis or, mm-hmm. or whatever. So for example, you know, in my cert, it would be nice to be able to say, I just had an executive visit a foreign country. I need to know what happened to that device.
Right.
So a log fee.
They maybe took it away because it was the United Arab Emirates.
That certainly could be the case, right? So we're kind of left with these crude situations where I have to image it. I have to poke around. This is, and, you know, didn't necessarily want to bring up the magic cloud word, but it really wonders. I really wonder about the cloud,
because you can't see.
Because I can't see.
That's the whole idea. It's foggy.
Right, you can't see anything. And you know, the Cloud Audit Group published their first sort of real document recently. I love that approach. But if there's not a way for me to tell, sort of in an independent way, how a device or a piece of software or a capability is operating, mm-hmm. that's when I get nervous.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly if it's that capability reporting itself. This is one of the reasons why I like the network, is the network doesn't lie. It's either there or it's not. Mm-hmm. And it's up to you to determine what it means when you see it. But if you sort of leave the endpoint, whatever it is, to be responsible for its own health and welfare and reporting, that's when I get nervous.
Mm-hmm. So kind of a change of gears here. You've worked as an independent consultant in a little one-guy shop.
One-man shop.
And also in a huge corporation in a 300,000
yes.
guy shop. So compare and contrast.
Yeah. So it's funny.
Did you not disappear in a puff of logic?
That's right. Right. So my boss, when he was interviewing me in early 07, he asked, how are you going to handle this? And I said, well, to me, this will just be, you know, the world's longest consulting engagement, because it's the same deal, right? I'm trying to meet someone's needs. And the attraction for me was being able to stay with the same client, essentially, not mm-hmm. just for weeks or months, but for years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm over the 3-year point at this point, and which I love. It's the longest place I've stayed outside of the Air Force, which mm-hmm. is great. Initially, it was very similar in the sense that I was a one-man shop at Dow Security. And then for a year, I was essentially almost a year and a half, I was a one-man shop at GE.
Mm-hmm.
I had obviously colleagues and such who worked with me, but I was the guy for incident response at the corporate level. Mm-hmm. The businesses had their capabilities, but I was more of a consultant, coordinator, and so forth. So in that respect, it was almost just very similar.
Mm-hmm.
Now, though, I have a team, and we're approaching, you know, we're approaching 40 people.
You're building your fiefdom.
Well, I prefer to think of it as a capability. In fact, that's one of the ways I justified the team size. I did some math comparing other companies who weren't even necessarily properly sized themselves,
yeah.
who may have been understaffed. And I said, if you were to do the math, my team should be calculated out across the whole company, 134 people.
Yeah.
And I said, I'll tell you what, though,
even
boss.
Even if this is wrong, divided by two.
Well, I said, I'll give you, you know, I'll make a deal with you here. I'll take off the one. Let's yeah. just have 34.
Yeah.
And of course, nothing happened right away, but I always had this plan in mind. And then once situation was favorable enough, and that's what I've done. I've worked very hard around what are the capabilities we need? How can I show you that these are the problems that we have? And by adding either manpower or additional software, in-house development, whatever it is, I'm going to make those problems decrease risk. And that's how we've been able to justify the additional hires. And then what ends up happening as well is, once you develop a capability, other parts of the business say, I want more of that. So they say, I want you to do more red teaming. What do you need to meet their schedule? And I say, well, shoot, I need 4 more people. And
yeah.
that's how the team grows.
Yeah. Where'd you get the data? Because, you know, one of the cool side effects of the BSIM work was we found out how big SSGs were and how big development teams were. And we did the math.
Yeah. So what
we came up with a 1% number, and everybody's like, holy cow, that's incredibly cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So what I did was GE is part of a group called the Defense Industrial Base.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a portal, and it's sort of 30 odd companies that participate. Mm-hmm. And then I have relationships with some other certs that I talk with pretty frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And I pulled them and I said, who would be willing to share with me the number of people you have doing detection response? What's the company size?
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to figure what's been the maturity level.
I mean, it's those basic things that are so helpful in the real world.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a second order answer. I would have much preferred, at least in the beginning,
it
to have said...
It should be structured like this.
Exactly. Yeah. And I had my thoughts. I mean, in the AFCERT, the AFCERT and the Air Force are very much like my company now. Almost the same employee count, except at the AFCERT, I had 100 people. Mm-hmm. And now I know the AFCERT is 300 people. Well, right. That's never going to happen in the commercial world. And I don't even know if it necessarily should. But it gave me a sense of, you know, at the level of myself and four expert level incident handlers in late 08, I said, no, this is not sufficient.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Last question. So I'm all excited about Arcade Fire's new CD that came out last week. What kind of music do you listen to?
Well, that's an interesting question. I actually have Johnny Cash on my MP3 player right now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, which one?
I have just sort of a collection of my favorite songs of his that I downloaded off of Amazon, which I find to be pretty neat.
Cool. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks, Gary. I appreciate the invitation.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by InformIT. The June-July issue of IEEE S&P digs into data privacy. With corporations collecting and collating so much data, how does privacy stand a chance? Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.